This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the historian Howard Ehrlichman, speaking with us today about the 16th century birth of the economic world order now known as globalization. Your new book, Howard, comes with the title Conquest, Tribute, and Trade. You describe the rise and fall of commercial empire in the 16th century, and in the telling of the tale, you find a template for our own 21st century distributions of wealth and poverty. Begin the story 5 centuries ago. Where were the great powers to be found, and what was the substance of their strength?
The great powers of the turn of the century in the year 1500 were 2 countries that were not in any way regarded as powers previously, Portugal and Spain, and a third power, the Ottoman Empire, which most people in Christian Europe were extremely concerned about. It was not a surprise that the Ottoman Empire was a formidable power in the year 1500. It was a really big surprise that Spain and Portugal had emerged almost out of nowhere and had evolved into the first truly global powers, mainly by accident. How did they do that? Columbus, as most of us know, headed west, discovered the West Indies, thinking that it was an archipelago off the coast of Japan, only to find out that it was not. Also, only to find out that in the case of Hispaniola and Cuba, both of those islands contained large quantities of gold, which prompted the Spanish crown to spend large amounts of energy on colonizing an area of the world that they hoped would help to reverse their own rather agrarian medieval past into something more dynamic. And that's exactly what happened. Portugal went east. Vasco da Gama, 1498, 6 years after Columbus, rounded the Cape of Good Hope. No European had done it since Roman times. Found that there was a whole host of Muslim trading enterprises lining the Indian Ocean on the east coast of Africa, all the way around the Gulf to the west coast of India. At that point, Portugal, another poor, agrarian, medieval mindset type country, essentially stumbled into one of the most lucrative business opportunities in world history. How did they do it? Da Gama was the front man for a follow-on series of expeditions by other Portuguese who gained access to a huge inventory of copper that had been developed under the care and direction of the House of Fugger, Jacob Fugger, the Nelson Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie of the late 15th century, stumbled upon a metallurgical process to treat, smelt poor quality copper in an efficient way that hadn't been done previously, and within a few years, in 1490s, had uncovered a huge treasure trove of copper, primarily in Hungary, also in Germany, in Tyrolia. Portugal accessed that copper, rounded the Cape of Good Hope, sold that copper to a host of, again, Muslim enterprises that lined the Indian Ocean, and cashed in on these arbitrage opportunities between low-cost copper that the Portuguese received from the Fugger monopoly in Europe, and they would arbitrage that against low-cost pepper and other spices that were required in India, carried the pepper back to Europe, marked it up at huge prices, and made huge profits. In both cases, getting back to the initial question, by the year 1500, Portugal had an evolving global empire, and Spain was in the West Indies on the cusp of invading the American mainland.
And the third power in 1500 is the Ottoman Empire. The Ottomans control the Mediterranean and control the spice trade coming into Europe.
That is correct. The Ottoman Empire was most definitely a formidable foe to Christian Europe. Christian Europe was extremely fragmented. It was at that time, before Martin Luther, in the break between Catholicism and Protestantism, relative united from a religious standpoint, and they were unified in their interest in stopping the Ottomans. The Ottomans conquered Constantinople, the great Byzantine capital of the former Eastern Roman Empire at one point, and that sent shockwaves through the system. Most of the Christian states, as fragmented as they were extremely interested in stopping the Ottomans. The Ottomans gradually and carefully and methodically marched their way up across the Dardanelles into the Balkans, southeastern Europe. They obtained some of the richest mining resources in the Balkans, in present-day Serbia, Kosovo, used those mineral resources to fund huge military armies and campaigns, and on 2 occasions in the first third of the 16th century, marched to the gates of Vienna and posed a formidable threat to the Habsburg Empire, which at that point controlled the mineral resources of Central Europe that had made the whole Portuguese system in the East work.
Throughout the 16th century, the Spanish exploit the mineral wealth of the Americas. The Portuguese trade the copper for the spice trade. What does Spain do with its suddenly vast amounts of bullion from the New World? And give us some idea of the scale of the wealth in both gold and silver.
Well, it was a gradual process. It started out, as I indicated, very superficially in terms of accessing gold on the island of Hispaniola, which is split between Haiti and the Dominican Republic today, then Cuba in the mid-15-teens, and after these gold reserves were worked down, depleted, exhausted, and the Native American populations of those two islands started to be decimated by primarily European diseases, there was a need for, on one hand, labor to work the gold fields and the sugar plantations that were also starting up at that time in the Indies. And Spain, by then, had sent a series of navigators along the Gulf of Mexico and was primed to invade the Mexican mainland in search of, on one hand, human labor to work the plantations and gold fields, and two, they had tantalizing hints of gold in the interior. As it turned out, there was not a lot of gold in the interior, but it turned out there'd be a ton of silver. And the silver that they found was primarily inland. By the 1520s and 1530, in the escarpment region southwest of present-day Mexico City, Hernan Cortes, who invaded Aztec Mexico in 1519 and conquered it, set it up as New Spain, he and some of his other entrepreneurial colleagues identified modest silver deposits in the escarpment region in the areas of present-day Soltepec, Taxco, which many people are familiar with today. But it was not until 1545, 1546, that a frontiersman, not really associated with Cortes or the Spanish crown, just one of these rough-and-ready adventurous-type guys, found a huge treasure trove of silver in Zacatecas, Mexico. And that unleashed a wholesale exploration effort in the wilds of Mexico that eventually followed most of the mountain ranges all the way up to present-day America, New Mexico, and even Texas. And Coronado is probably the most famous of these conquistadors who traveled all the way up from central Mexico to the wilds of present-day Kansas in search of mineral resources and found nothing.
Meanwhile, also in the 16th century, there are vast discoveries of silver in Bolivia and Peru. How does that work?
Well, Bolivia, as it turned out, was even more lucrative, spectacular than Zacatecas. And Zacatecas, to put it in some kind of a comparative framework, was larger than any existent mine in Central Europe. Cerro de Potosí in the wilds of Bolivia was an outgrowth of the Pizarro brothers' invasion of Inca Peru in the 1530s and their slow but steady conquest of the former Inca Empire. The treasure troves that the Pizarros uncovered in Cajamarca and Cusco, and these are huge, huge amounts of money, but these were ceremonial treasures. These were gilded and silvered objects that were used by the Inca, again, for ceremonial and in regal and festival-type events that had nothing to do with mining and metallurgy, except for the fact that they had been fabricated from precious metal deposits of some kind. The Pizarros and a host of other Spaniards were involved with a feverish rush to find the geological source of these ceremonial treasures. Finally, in the late 1530s, 1540, Hernan Pizarro, not as famous as Francisco Pizarro, found a mining site in Porco, Bolivia, that was the largest silver mine to date. Porco, within a few miles of Cerro de Potosí, which turned out to be the great monster, the largest silver mine in the Western Hemisphere, was uncovered in 1545 as an outgrowth of the Pizarro brothers' feverish quest for precious metals in Peru and Bolivia.
So, throughout the 16th century, an enormous flow of bullion to Spain and Portugal from the New World and Portugal from its trading in the Indian Ocean. What do these countries do with their wealth? You have a chapter that is called Unimaginable Wealth and Squander.
Some of the mines that I mentioned, primarily Zacatecas and Cerro de Potosí, the volume of precious metals, silver, being produced in these mines were just off the charts in terms of anything that had been uncovered anywhere in the world to date. The Spanish crown knew about these resources. And what one of the great ironies of history was that the more money that was being sent across the Atlantic to the coffers of Holy Roman Empire Emperor Charles V, who was also the King of Spain, and his successor, his son, Felipe II of Spain, the more money that was being generated from the mines of Mexico, Bolivia, in the gold fields of Colombia, which is also significant, would prompt these kings to conduct military campaigns that they probably would not have done otherwise. In the course of doing that, they would use these metals as security to issue bonds that would be sold to the general public. What would typically happen is, in the case of the Ottoman Empire, France, and a concurrent campaign against German Protestantism, which was also all happening at about the same time. We're in the 1540s now. The military cost with which to try to defeat these three formidable powers was just daunting. They were fighting three wars at the same time. They're using the precious metals from the West to secure the bonds, to pay the troops, outfit the ships that were engaged with the Ottomans. There was never enough money to maintain the campaigns, which resulted in cash flow deficits, which resulted in additional borrowings to bridge these shortfalls in the repayment schedules on the debt. And you have this never-ending spiral of financial sinkhole, all prompted by unprecedented mineral wealth from the West.
So there's some sort of parallel with our own military spending.
There definitely is, and I would add to the parallel with current day events in that there are certain wars that need to be fought. The campaign by, from their standpoint, the Western Christian powers against the Islamic forces of the Ottoman Empire, that was a war from their standpoint they had to fight. If they didn't fight it, the Ottomans were marching up the Danube River, they would have taken Vienna. It was the gateway to the Habsburg mining properties in Central Europe. Once they got those funds, they would have even larger amounts of money to hire more mercenaries and march on Germany, France, and who knows what. That's a war, I think, that needed to be fought from their standpoint. German Protestantism, that's another thing. These are intolerant Christian powers that were trying to impose a brand of Catholicism that was actually very humanistic for its day, on people, populations in France, in the Netherlands, and in Germany that had different versions of Christianity. And that's a war that was as inconclusive as one might think. So in that case, they're spending huge amounts of money on a war that was probably not going to be won because the hearts and minds of the Protestants, the literal Protestants, were somewhere else. So the analogy with the current day affairs is that some wars may be worth fighting and others are not. And in that case, it's sort of a U.S. versus the Taliban type situation where I'm in no way a fan of the Taliban, but from their standpoint, from an Islamic standpoint, they feel they're defending their faith, and it's going to be a hearts and minds battle that I think we're all struggling with today.
But the wars are enormously expensive. Squander is the word you use. Perhaps just a necessary war against the Ottomans, because throughout most of the 16th century, the Mediterranean is in fact an Ottoman lake. But then the religious wars in the Netherlands are equally expensive. So toward the end of the 16th century, you have the Iberian powers tending toward bankruptcy. Where then does the wealth flow?
That really is the crux of the century, I guess, from my standpoint in developing the research and the analysis for the book. They were not winning wars that maybe needed to be fought, and they were not winning wars that may not have needed to be fought. And when you're fighting three powers at the same time, the Ottomans, France, German Protestants, which are the three formidable opponents, and you have limited resources despite the unprecedented wealth in the West, you have a problem. Again, what happens is that they're using the mineral resources to secure the bonds that are not being repaid. They're being rolled over. The interest rates and the expense on the bonds are much higher than the initial issues. So you have this spiraling effect where a war that might have cost X amount of monies ends up costing 5X times money, and there just is not enough money in the treasury, the royal treasury of the Habsburg Empire, and the Castilian treasury to finance it. So you have a declaration of bankruptcy with all the creditors, which are primarily the House of Fugger, which had jump-started the whole thing with their copper empire, and the Genoese, who are the other primary lenders and creditors to the Habsburg Empire. So what happens is, very similar to what we just saw in the United States with the government bailouts, huge investment banks, Fuggers, Genoese, were forced to write down the carrying value of their investments, take huge hits, and the ripple effect through the economic system was just massive. So after a few years of clearing that out, finally, the crown is in a position to start the process all over again, and that's what happened.
What happens in the meantime to the native populations in the Americas?
While all this is going on, I mean, there's all these things going on. The Spanish invade the Western Hemisphere with a very small number of people. There are no regular armies. We're in the teens and the hundreds in terms of the Cortez and Pizarro. They typically enlisted allies from Native American populations. So you can claim that the Western invasion of the Americas resulted in this absolute devastation of the populations of Native America. What happened was that the Europeans carried over a variety of diseases that were just too overwhelming for the immunity systems of these Native Americans to deal with.
Give us some idea of the scale, Howard. How many Native Mexicans at the beginning of the 16th century and how many left at the end?
Reasonably good estimates for the population of Central Mexico prior to the invasion of Hernan Cortez in 1519 was 25 to 35 million people. By the year 1600, it was below 1 million. I'll repeat that. From, say, a low bound of 25 million to 1 million in the space of 100 years. Peru, Inca Peru, went from around 9 million to less than 1 million.
And the devastation of the demographic is what gives rise to the slave trade in the 16th and 17th century.
That's absolutely right. One of the underreported aspects of this whole time period is the reasons behind the acceleration of the slave trade. Now, the Portuguese, when they invaded commercially the coastline of Africa, starting in the mid-15th century, were trading slaves on a relatively modest basis, in terms of maybe 1,000 a year. And most of them would be shipped to Lisbon and eventually shipped over to the Portuguese sugar plantations in Brazil. As the Native American population who performed most of the dirty work in the mines, in the agricultural estates, in the Spanish colonial economic system in the West, as these people started to die out from disease, the Spaniards needed sources of labor. So they ramped up this very modest African slave trade from, again, maybe 1,000 persons a year on a continuing basis that just accelerated. It correlated to the depopulation figures that I just mentioned before.
Get to the end of the 16th century. You end your book roughly the year 1609, by which time the Dutch Republic is the most powerful nation state in the world. Amsterdam is the richest city. How does that happen?
It's another one of these great accidents, the way I would look at it. Although when you take a step back, it's not so accidental after all, if you take a look at it carefully. In the same way that Portugal and Spain really came out of nowhere at the start of the 16th century, the Dutch were the ones that cashed in on the mismanagement, and I'll focus primarily on Spain initially, the mismanagement of the Spanish Empire. When Spain had to declare bankruptcies in 1557, 1560, and then 1575, it unsettled the Spanish economic system to such an extent that it created opportunities for entrepreneurial and enterprising business people from other people, it turned out to be the Dutch and to a lesser extent the English, to cash in on their misfortune. At the same time, the Spanish Netherlands was in the middle of a civil war which was prompted by this split between the Spanish crown's desire to impose their brand of Catholicism on the Netherlands while other parts of the Netherlands were moving towards Calvinism and Lutheranism. So you had this religious split that prompted, in many ways, an economic backlash against something that was otherwise religious and spiritual.
But the predominance of the Dutch Republic is in itself short-lived, and by the next century, the commercial empire has moved first to Britain and then to the United States.
Well, that's correct, but to finish the thought on the Dutch, they exploited the mismanagement, the miscalculation, the financial disaster that was brought about by the Spanish monarchs to fuse together two global empires that were assembled by the Portuguese in the East and the Spanish in the West, focused primarily on business and enterprise. The Dutch probably would not have been as successful if, because England was their arch rival, their former ally in the early years in terms of the Dutch Republic of 1580 to 1600. But they gradually split because the Dutch and the English became economic rivals themselves. What happened in England was that after the death of Elizabeth in 1603, England gradually devolved into a religious war of religion of their own between Catholics and Protestants that took them, which spiraled downward into the famous English Civil War, which really took England out of the geopolitical landscape and gave the Dutch really a free hand in terms of exploiting and consolidating the Spanish and Portuguese empires that they had fused together.
Thank you, Howard Ehrlichman, for speaking with us today about the 16th century birth of globalization. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2010.